What?
Miranda said. Milo just left the office with a gun, I said. My words took a while to impact, and even when they did, the effect was dull. Miranda's brown eyes slid down to my chin, then my chest, then to her own hands. She pushed the Doritos away.
You know where he's going?
Yes.
He's trying something dangerous for me.
Yes. Ralph ate, looking back and forth between us. His expression had all the depth of someone watching a barroom TV program. When he finished his tamale, he wiped his hands and then spread them, a here-I-am gesture. Maybe so, I agreed. Ralph slowly broke into a grin, like I'd given him an answer he'd been expecting for days. I looked at Miranda. You could stay here. Ralph is right. He and I could take care of it for you. Miranda flushed. Anger seemed to be burning the marijuana slowness out of her eyes.
I'm coming. Just tell me where we're going.
Ralph straightened up his chair so he could take out Mr. Subtle, his .357 Magnum. He clunked it on the table and said,
Dessert.
Chapter 54. The night sky was bright with thunderclouds and the air smelled like metal. The raindrops were infrequent, warm, and large as birds' eggs. Ralph pulled the maroon Cadillac in behind the VW on the north side of Nacogdoches, about half a block down from the entrance of the storage facility. He met us by the chain-link fence of the sulfur processing plant. The wind was whipping around, pushing Miranda's hair into her mouth. Her white Berkeley t-shirt was freckled with rain. Bad, I told Ralph. Across the street, the gates of the flood-lit facility were open crookedly. Shaq's huge black pickup truck was just outside. The security booth was empty. Milo's green Jeep Cherokee was parked at a 45-degree angle across the entrance. Its fender crunched against the booth's doorway and its driver's side door open. If the guard had been in the booth, he would have had to crawl over Milo's hood to get out. From this angle, I couldn't see the yard between the two buildings. Monday night, traffic along Nacogdoches was light. What cars there were turned into the industrial parkway before getting to our block. Two blocks down, five or six teenagers were waiting at the VIA bus stop. Ralph looked at the yard.
No cover worth shit. Chavez, man, stupid ass isn't worth saving.
You can back out, I said. No obligation. Ralph grinned.
Mande.
I nodded my thanks, then looked at Miranda. She was hugging her elbows. Her brows were knit together. On the ride north, she'd managed to shake off most of the effects of the laced pan dulce. But she still had a withdrawn, slightly puffed-up demeanor, like a very cold parakeet on a perch. She shifted her weight onto one leg and lifted the other boot behind her knee.
What can I do?
I think it was meant to sound brave, gung-ho. It came out plaintive. I got out my wallet and gave Miranda one of Detective Jean Schaefer's cards, which I'd had the unhappy fortune to collect on many occasions. You can stay here if you want, I told her. Be our anchor. Ralph has a cell phone. You hear any trouble, any shots, call that number and ask for homicide. Jean Schaefer. Insist on talking to him. Tell him where we are and what's happening, and tell him to get on the phone with Samuel Barrera and get down here. We're giving them probable cause to enter. Do you have all that? Miranda nodded uncertainly. Ralph looked at me, produced his fallback gun, a Dan Wesson .38, and held it toward me.
I know what you're going to say, Vato, but I got to offer.
No, thanks.
I'll take it, Miranda said.
She did, gingerly. She held the gun correctly, pointed it down, unlatched the barrel, and rolled it, checking the cylinders. She closed it and looked at me defiantly.
I'm not being an anchor.
Then to Ralph,
take your own damn cell phone.
Ralph laughed.
This lady's all right, man. Vamos.
He got out Mr. Subtle. We crossed Nacogdoches and walked toward the gates, staying close to the fence. By the time we got there, rain was coming down heavy enough to make a high-pitched pinging against the corrugated metal roofs of the storage buildings. In the yard were the same two freight boxes, that were there that afternoon, but this time they were attached to semi-rigs with the motors running. One loading bay door was open. No one was on the dock, but looking underneath the first truck, we could see long shadows from two pairs of legs on the other side, men talking between the trucks. One of them wore jeans and boots. The other had slacks, dress shoes. I turned to Miranda. Last chance. But it was already happening too fast. Ralph knew when to take advantage, and he knew there wouldn't be a better chance to close some distance. He went right, walking quickly toward the cab of the truck. I moved left to the side of the building and began jogging toward the first loading dock. Miranda followed me. The gunshots came when we were almost to the dock. I was running forward before I fully registered what I had heard. Two shots, both incredibly loud, from inside the warehouse, followed quickly by two shots from the right, behind the first truck. Those had been almost as loud, the report of a .357. Ralph had taken advantage of timing again. We met Ralph under the loading dock, where metal slats had been laid across from the cement to the truck bed. The dock was only about 5 feet high, so we had to crouch to avoid being seen from inside. Ralph had his gun out and was shaking his head, whispering Spanish curses and looking mildly displeased. Behind him were some low-pitched groans, almost muffled in the rain and the truck engines.
Cabrones tried to get smart. One of them might live, I think.
I looked under the truck. On the opposite side, 30 yards away, the man in the slacks and the T-shirt, who had been with Jean Krause in the BMW earlier in the day, was curled up on the asphalt, a pistol about 10 feet away from him, kicked there by Ralph, probably. The man was making the groans as he tried to stop the bleeding in his thigh. He was kicking himself along the pavement with his good leg like he was trying to get somewhere, but he was only succeeding in making small circles. His fingers clutched his leg where the blood was seeping through, soaking his pants and smearing the pavement. He'd gone at least one complete circle in his own pool because the blood was on his face and in his hair, too. In the outdoor lights, the sticky places glistened purple. Red-haired Elgin Garwood was 10 feet closer to us. He was very dead. A .357 round had eaten a fist-sized chunk out of his chest, just to the left of his sternum. He was staring at the sky, and rain was running off his forehead. His 9mm was still in his right hand. My ears roared. I tried to think, but the engines and the rain and the after-echo of gunfire made it impossible. Inside the warehouse, an argument was going on, more groaning. Was it possible they hadn't recognized the gunfire outside as a separate problem? Maybe the echo inside the building... A carload of high school kids drove by on Nacogdoches. Oblivious, grins on their faces, heavy metal music blaring. I held my breath, then popped my head up for a brief look into the warehouse. A 2-second snapshot. Tilden Sheckley and Jean Krause arguing, Sheckley with a gun stuck in the waist of his pants, Krause's Beretta in his hand. The apparent subject of the argument, a mountain of wounded human being on the floor in front of them. Milo Chavez. The soles of his very expensive shoes pointed toward me, one hand clutching at his shoulder, maybe his heart. A single line of blood ran away from his body, stopping after 2 feet, to seep into and around a legal-sized document that Milo had apparently dropped, then continuing. I ducked back down and pressed my back against the cement wall of the loading dock. I closed my eyes and tried to memorize the placement of things. When I opened my eyes again, I was looking at Miranda. Her face was pale, her hand pressed lightly over her mouth. She was staring under the truck, watching the man kick a circular path through his own blood, watching the other one with the hole in his chest, the one who had brought his wife, Karen, to Willis's parties. She started shaking. Get the hell out, Ralph. I grabbed the cell phone from him, then, with much greater hesitation, traded it with Miranda for the .38 Wesson. You just killed a cop. An Avalon County deputy, but still a cop. Miranda goes too. Miranda makes the call to Schaefer. Neither of you were ever here. Ralph's face hardened. The lenses of his glasses gleamed solid yellow. He rubbed his thumb along the safety catch of the .357.
That's too bad, Vato.
No, I said, but I couldn't stop it. Ralph crouched just low enough for the shot. The muzzle blast flared, illuminating the underside of the truck. The man who had been kicking a circle in his own blood stopped kicking. A new red pattern, less circular, began seeping into the asphalt around his head. I counted 3 very long seconds. Miranda crouched next to us, stone still. Her face had the dazed, unhappy, sated look of someone who was just realizing that she'd overdone it at the banquet table. Ralph turned to me, gave a very small, cold smile.
Ain't standing in no lineup for Milo Chavez, Vato. Lo siento.
Then he was gone. Miranda whisked into his wake and pulled along willingly or no, and I didn't have the luxury of thinking. There had been a third shot. John Kraus would be coming out. It had been almost 20 years since I fired a gun. I moved 5 feet to the left and turned. Lifted above the lip of the loading dock just enough to see, and fired around toward the roof, roughly in the direction Sheck and Kraus had been standing. Sheck was still there, but now partially crouched behind a large wooden crate. Kraus was 20 feet closer to the entrance. When I fired, he almost fell over himself, backtracking. I didn't have time to notice if Milo was still breathing. I ducked and moved toward the side steps of the loading dock. I yelled,
"Sheckley! 2 men are down out here. The police have been called. We've got about 3 minutes to work this thing out."
Miranda and Ralph had disappeared through the gates. There were no sirens, yet. A huge drop of rain caught me on the nose, forcing me to blink. Inside, it was silent, until Sheckley let out a strained noise, a poor imitation of a laugh.
"You just don't give up, son, do you? You think I'm going to stop to sign old Milo's papers right now? I'm sorry, I'm a little busy."
I was at the top of the steps now, my body flat against the wall just outside the entrance.
"You wanted Chavez shot?" I called. "Was that your idea? If I was you, Sheck, I'd put some distance between myself and Kraus right now."
I crouched, looked in, and nearly got my head shot off anyway. Kraus had targeted effectively. I fired back, stupidly, ineffectually, into the air and ducked around the corner again. My hand was already numb from the recoil. The smell of primer was in my nose. God, I hate guns. In my third snapshot look, I'd noticed a few new things. There were rows and rows of large cylinders, stacked, upright, just behind Kraus. Each was about 7 inches in diameter and 5 or 6 feet high, wrapped in brown paper and capped on either end with plastic, like huge canisters for architects' drawings. The other thing I noticed was Sheckley. He'd been standing again, making no attempt to find cover, and he wasn't staring at the entrance looking for me. He was staring at Milo Chavez's chest. Chavez's hand had fallen away from the shoulder and was now limp at his side. That was not good. John Kraus called out,
"There is nothing we can't discuss, Mr. Navarre."
His voice was collected, genial, a little too loud to be trusted.
"Your friend needs a doctor's attention, I think. Perhaps we should call a truce."
"Go on, Navarre," Sheckley called. "Get out of here."
"Let's discuss it," I called.
"Like Kraus says. Did he tell you about the 13-year-old French boy he killed? Kraus discussed his way out of that one real well. I imagine he'll do the same here. Get safely to another country and leave you with the wreckage and the bodies, Tilden. How does that sound?"
Kraus's voice came back a little bit louder and a little less genial. He made sure I heard the action on the Beretta as he chambered the next round.
"I have my gun pointed at your friend's head, Mr. Navarre. At present, he can still be saved. Throw your gun into the doorway and come into the warehouse, and perhaps I will reconsider my options. Do you understand?"
Sheckley said something very insistent in German, an order. Kraus responded derisively in the same language. Sheck barked the same command again, and Kraus laughed. Somewhere, very far away, there were sirens. The rain kept falling in my face, soaking through my shirt.
No good, Shaq, I yelled. Give it up, and I'll make sure they listen to you. Let Kraus and his associates be the ones they lynch. Otherwise, we're talking multiple murders in Huntsville and a bunch of guys in Luxembourg laughing their ass off about you. What's it going to be? One, Kraus started to count. Milo Chavez managed a noise, a low mumble that might have been a scream if not for weakness and shock. Shaq barked something else in German, and Kraus yelled, Two! And I gave up hope and came barreling into the doorway to fire when guns went off. Not mine. I remember Jean Kraus raising his Beretta toward Shaq, and Shaq drawing his .41 faster than anything I've ever seen, and both men firing. Three rapid red bubbles expanded and burst in the back of Kraus's white turtleneck. Kraus lurched backward into a forest of upright CD spools and sent them crashing to the floor. Plastic caps shot off and three CDs spilled out like metallic poker chips, slishing colorfully across the cement. Three. The aftermath was incredibly quiet. The rain drummed on the corrugated metal overhead. The truck engines hummed. I swear I could hear the rattle of Milo's breath. Shaq stared at me. His eyes were dull. He wiped the sweat off his lip with the back of his gun hand, took a step back, and stumbled against the crate where he'd been hiding a moment before. There were giant sweat rings like half moons under the arms of his denim shirt. One of his boots had come untucked from his jeans. His hat was knocked sideways at a funny angle, and he was bleeding from the scar Allison had given him a few days ago, now burst out of its little squares of tape, and from a streak of blood on his arm, where Jean's bullet had grazed through the shirt, ripping the fabric and a layer of skin neatly away. The sirens were getting louder. I looked at Jean Krause's body in the CDs. He was bent over the tubes of music at a funny angle, his head too far back and his chest too far out. One of the canisters had fallen into the crook of his arm, so he seemed to be holding it like an oversized spear. One leg was folded unnaturally behind him. His eyes were open, as black and fierce as ever. I crouched next to Milo and looked into his face. I couldn't tell anything. He continued to breathe and to bleed. The wound was in his shoulder, probably no internal organs hit. His eyes were glazed and unfocused. I looked at Shaq. He was breathing shallowly, like he was trying to remember how. When he looked at me and laughed, the noise sounded more like a pained whimper, like he was getting something cauterized. I can talk, son, he told me. I'll talk. Hell, I've weathered worse. As the sirens approached and I tended to Milo's wounds, Sheckley paced around the warehouse, kicking at the pirate CDs, laughing and mumbling to Jean Krause's corpse that he'd weathered worse. Like maybe if he said it a few hundred more times, he might come to believe it. Chapter 55. Tuesday and Wednesday were a blur. I remember cops. Milo Chavez in the hospital. More cops. I remember sleeping in an interrogation room for several hours, speaking to Sam Barrera and Gene Schaefer on several occasions, and meeting Barrera's nice friends from the FBI and ATF. When I dreamt about giving pints of blood over and over and asking for donuts and water and getting nothing but little smiley face stickers that said, I'm a donor. I woke Thursday morning on the futon at 90 Queen Anne, wondering how I got there. Vague memories started surfacing about a ride in the back of a mustard-yellow BMW. Someone who smelled like Aramis, cursing my father's name as he trundled me out of the car and dragged me up the stairs and tucked me roughly into bed. I blinked the crust out of my eyes. Robert Johnson was curled around my feet. The TV was on. I stared at the pretty colors and the plastic faces of anchor people. Slowly, the sounds they were making became English. They were recapping the story of the week,
telling me things I already knew. We'd had the second largest bust of pirate and bootleg audio CDs in U.S. history, right here in the Alamo City. $1.5 million netted in cash over the last 2 days, and 350,000 titles by over 90 country artists, all precipitated by a police response to gunfire at a Northside warehouse Monday evening. 3 men had been killed before police arrived. One of the victims was an Avalon County deputy who'd apparently been in collusion with the pirates. The other 2 victims were Luxembourg nationals, a falling out among thieves, one reporter had called it. Tilden Sheckley, country music entrepreneur, had been taken into custody at the scene and was cooperating with authorities about his connections to the European smuggling ring. He had led customs officials to 3 separate warehouses full of merchandise and cash and several boxes of automatic weapons that the ATF claimed were the first shipments of a fledgling gun-running operation, piggybacking off the CD distribution network. Several recent murders in the San Antonio area had now been linked to the Luxembourg organization, and at least 1 foreign national was still at large, wanted for the slaying of the Avalon County deputy, Elgin Garwood. The anchorman showed the wanted man's face, the 3rd man who'd been in Jean Krause's BMW, and gave a name I didn't recognize. The murder weapon had been found several blocks away. A .357 caliber pistol, wiped of prints, unregistered. A search was underway for locally based talent agent Les St. Pierre. According to Samuel Barrera, RIAA's contracted private investigator and hero of the day, Mr. St. Pierre was not a suspect in any crime. Rather, St. Pierre had disappeared while acting as an informant for the authorities and was, sadly, presumed dead. As for Tilden Sheckley, he was a small fish. When pressed, the SAPD spokesman confirmed that Sheck stood a good chance of lenient charges if, as promised, he could help authorities in several states and at least 3 EU countries with information on his Luxembourg partners. I turned off the TV. I managed a shower, then some cold cereal. Around 10 o'clock, I called a friend of mine in the Express News Entertainment section and got the rest of the story. The inside scoop in music industry circles was that Les St. Pierre had actually embezzled tens of thousands from his own agency and disappeared to the Caribbean. Some said Mazatlan. Others said Brazil. Many said he'd been working with the Luxembourgians. The agency he'd headed had collapsed over the last 48 hours, although one of Les's associates, Milo Chavez, had heroically confronted the pirates and blown the whole operation open. Chavez was said to be recovering nicely and putting together a lucrative deal for Miranda Daniels with Century Records. As a result of that and the good publicity, Chavez had employment offers from several large Nashville agencies. Reportedly, with Milo would come Miranda Daniels as a client, and a large number of former St. Pierre talent. Milo had apparently underestimated himself. According to my friend at the Express News, the Miranda Daniels developmental tape featured strong material and was as good as a surefire gold record. It had a strong buzz going, whatever that meant. My friend expected the deal to go through with Century Records and Miranda to be on the Billboard charts by New Year's. He said the human interest angle really helped. First and foremost, the recent tragic death of Miranda's brother, who had written some of her best songs. The murder of her former fiddle player helped, too. "The tabloids are eating this up," Carlin McCaffrey told me. "You don't happen to have an in with this Chavez guy, do you? Or Daniels?" I hung up the phone. I did Tai Chi on the back porch until almost noon. Halfway through the long form, my muscles started to burn the right way again. The vacuous sick feeling in my stomach faded. Once I got into the sword form, I could almost concentrate again. The phone rang just as I was completing the last section. I went inside and caught it on the 3rd ring. Kelly Arguello said, "Alan Meissner." "What?" "Get a pen, stupid." I pulled one out of the crack in the ironing board. Kelly rattled off a social security number. a Texas driver's license number, a flight number.
Meissner applied for the Social Security number 2 months ago, she said, at age 45. Got his license at DMV 2 weeks ago, then plane tickets to New York on American booked for tomorrow. Good trick, considering the guy died in 95. Meissner used to be an in-house auditor for Texas Instruments.
Holy shit, I said. You did say before Friday, didn't you?
You found him.
Kelly laughed.
That's what I've been trying to tell you, Chico Loco. Your client's going to be happy?
I stared at the flight number. When was this reservation made?
Yesterday.
Hey, this is good news, right?
I hesitated.
Absolutely.
You're incredible, Kelly. I've been trying to tell you that, too. Now, about that dinner.
Talk to Ralph.
Oh, please.
Not that again.
I leaned down against the ironing board and ran my fingers into my hair. I closed my eyes and listened to the slight crackle of the phone line.
No, I said. I mean, you should call him.
She spent a few silent moments trying to interpret my tone.
What happened? What'd you two get into this time?
You just need to call him, okay? Even better, get down here. Spend a day with him, okay? He needs... I don't know. I think he needs to be reminded you're around. Some niecely influence.
Niecely is a word? Hey, English PhD here, back off. This is the thanks I get for helping you.
You'll do it?
Kelly sighed.
I'll do it.
I'll also come to see you.
She said it like it was the deadliest threat she could make. I smiled in spite of myself.
Bueno?
She asked.
Bueno,
I agreed. Chapter 56. It was Friday morning before I spoke to Milo and Miranda again. I never found out how Miranda's things got picked up from the safe house on the south side. Ralph just handled it somehow. Ralph didn't call me. That told me something. Milo and Miranda arranged to meet me at the Sunset Cafe for breakfast. Gladys, the ex-receptionist for the ex-Les St. Pierre agency, set up the appointment. The Sunset Cafe was the kind of place you drive right by, an adobe one-room shack on the ridge rising from Broadway, wedged between an art gallery and an insurance office. Despite its name, the casino opened early and closed early, serving egg and bacon and carne guisada tacos and strong coffee to blue collars. When I pulled the VW up the steep driveway and into the tiny parking lot, Milo's Jeep was already there. The Daniels' brown and white Ford pickup was also in the lot, minus the horse trailer. Willis Daniels was sitting in the driver's seat. If he noticed me walking up, he didn't let on, at least not until I stood at the window for a few seconds. The old man looked up from his book and smiled a tight smile.
Mr. Navarre?
He offered to shake, gentlemanly. His hand lacked any of the energy it had had when I'd first shaken it, outside Silo Studios 100 years ago.
You not hungry?
I asked. The smile took on a kind of sad amusement.
I'd just be in the way. You gone.
He went back to his book, sighed. It would have been easier if he'd yelled at me, or frowned at least. I went inside. Milo and Miranda were drinking coffee at the table by the window. Saying Milo looked nice is superfluous, but somehow there was shock value in seeing him immaculate again after the way he'd looked on that warehouse floor, then in the hospital bed. His trousers were dark and freshly pressed, his white shirt crisp with starch. The bandages underneath the shirt made his left shoulder look bulkier than the right. He was wearing a diamond stud earring, and his short-cropped black hair looked freshly trimmed along the edges. He hooked a pink chair with his fingers and dragged it out from the table.
Have a seat, Trace.
I sat between them. Miranda was wearing lightly tinted round sunglasses. She'd chosen all white today, long skirt, blouse with just enough mother-of-pearl studs to put it into the Western category, white ankle-length boots. Even her hair, dark and curly, was pulled back in a white headband, making her forehead look high and her sunglasses that much more obvious. She was looking into her coffee, holding it with both hands. She glanced up briefly at me, then down again. Here? I set my shoebox next to Milo's untouched plate of tinfoil-wrapped tacos. Milo scowled, lifted the lid, then closed it again. At a table across the way, one of the construction workers had apparently seen what was inside the box. He said, "Holy shit," very quietly, and nudged his friend.
"You brought me cash?" Milo asked, incredulous. "That's the way I found it."
Milo looked at me, a little puzzled by my tone.
"All right. 50,000?
"Half." He looked at me longer. "Problem?" I asked.
"Very possibly."
"The rest I'm giving to Allison. The way things are shaping up, it may be the only thing she gets out of this deal." Milo let his eyes slide over to Miranda, who looked suddenly very sad.
"Allison," Milo repeated. "You know that this is agency money, Les's and mine. You know she doesn't have claim to it. Why the fuck?
You want to talk to the IRS? Go. I'm sure you were planning on reporting this recovered." Milo closed his mouth. His eyes had the bull fierceness in them, but he was trying hard to keep it from the surface.
"I hoped we could be a little more constructive here. I didn't want..."
He shook his head, disappointed.
"Christ, Trace, it's not like we don't owe you something, but..."
He let me see a little bit inside, a little bit of hurt and discomfort. The sense that we were still friends. I turned to Miranda. "You happy with your deal?" The question took her by surprise, or maybe it was just the fact that I spoke to her at all. She sat up, away from me just slightly.
"I will be, yes. I'm grateful to you, but..."
She was steeling herself to say something, probably something she'd rehearsed with Milo before coming here. She couldn't quite manage it. She swallowed and looked on the verge of tears. It was a look she did well.
"Miranda's relocating to Nashville," Milo supplied. "We both are."
I turned my attention back to him.
"You both are."
Somehow the words seemed absurd. I felt like I was speaking Spanish when I hit an unfamiliar colloquialism and the sense of almost being fluent came to a grinding stop. Milo unwrapped one of his tacos, peeling back the tin foil with the detached interest of a coroner. A plume of steam zigzagged up from the eggs.
"We've been lucky things have worked out as well as they have," he explained. "Very lucky. We owe you for that. But we thought it would be best. Miranda needs to be closer to the action."
I stared at Miranda. She wouldn't meet my eyes.
"We just wanted you to know," Milo continued. "There's a lot of outstanding problems from all of this. Until Miranda's career really gets going, things are going to be fragile. Miranda needs a clean break from everything that's happened."
I kept staring.
"She's lost family here," Milo continued. "She can't keep being reminded of that. We want to make sure you feel compensated, but you need to be out of the picture, Trace."
"I'm going to insist on that." "Compensated," I said, another foreign term. I looked at Miranda. "You plan on compensating the others, too? Cam? Sheck? Les? How about Brent and Julie Kearns?" Miranda wiped a tear away. She was wavering between sorrow and anger, trying to decide what approach would be the most effective.
"That ain't fair, Trace," she muttered hoarsely. "It just ain't."
I nodded.
"How long until Milo gets the clean break message from somebody in Nashville? Some slightly bigger big shot who's decided he can look out for your interests better?
A week ago you told me Allison was the only person who scared you to death, Miranda."
"I've met somebody scarier." "Stop," Milo insisted.
He was strictly lawyer now. Our relationship was about 30 seconds old and would fade as soon as the conversation was over, like finger pokes on bread dough. I stood to leave. The waitress came over and offered me coffee apologetically, apparently thinking she'd been too slow. When I didn't respond, she raised her eyebrows, offended, and walked away.
"You kept your promise, Chavez," I said. "You made sure things didn't work out like last time."
I walked outside. When I got to the car, Willis Daniels didn't even bother looking up from his book. He was smiling his peaceful Santa Claus Day After Christmas smile. Through the window of the Sunset Cafe, I could see Miranda crying, Milo's huge hand on her shoulder. He was speaking to her reassuringly, probably telling her she'd done what she had to do, that it got easier from here. There was nobody in the VW to do that for me. It was just as well. I would have slugged them. I turned right on Broadway and headed for the airport. I had a plane to say goodbye to. Chapter 57. San Antonio's main terminal was lollipop-shaped. A long corridor with a carousel of gates at the end. At the center of the circle was a magazine kiosk and a pricey snack shop and a souvenir stand where you had your last chance to buy authentic Texas pickled jalapenos and stuffed armadillos and rattlesnake and plastic toilet seats. The American flight for New York would be departing from Gate 12. I was an hour early. A flight from Denver had just deplaned. A few businessmen, a couple of college kids, lots of pale retirees, winter Texans. I got myself a $4 draft beer at the bar and sat at a table behind a row of bromeliads, facing the gate. At the table next to me, a couple of out-of-uniform airmen were trading stories. They'd just been let out of basic training at Lackland and were heading home on leave for a week. One of them was talking about his wife. Nobody I wanted to see came to the gate. The desk wasn't checking anybody's tickets yet. A couple of stewardesses ambled out of the gate, all blonde hair and long legs and wheeled luggage. The overweight captain walked behind them, appreciating the view. Over by the window, a little Latino kid who reminded me a lot of Jem was putting his face against the glass wall of the observation area. He blew his mouth against the glass until his cheeks puffed out, then ran a few feet and did it again. The glass was a smudgy, drooling, foggy mess for a good 20 feet. Dad was a couple of rows away, watching sports coverage on an overhead TV. He probably wasn't much older than I was. The kid was probably 5. Finally, a ticket checker changed the signs on the gate display. New York, on time. He clacked a few keys on his computer terminal, then joked a little with one of the airport custodians. Passengers started to arrive. The airmen got up and left, shaking hands. One was heading to Montana. I didn't know about the other. I bought another $4 beer. The little Latino boy got tired of sliming the windows and came over to climb on his dad. Dad didn't much care. Pretty soon it looked like Dad was growing a small pair of flailing blue kids out of his shoulder blades. Finally, the newly christened Alan Meissner arrived, 20 minutes before flight time, just before the airline would start pre-boarding. He was wearing a cowboy hat that shaded his face pretty well, and clear glasses and faded denim clothes that weren't his normal look. He dyed his hair a shade or two lighter, and I suspected that his cowboy boots were a little taller than they needed to be. He'd taken lessons on how to disguise himself, just like he'd taken lessons on how to construct his new paper identity. He wouldn't have attracted any casual onlookers. He would have stood a fair chance of slipping by any random encounters with acquaintances, unless they knew who they were looking for. I did. He was definitely my man. The new Mr. Meissner was traveling light, a single backpack, dark green. It was pretty much exactly like mine. I walked up behind him as he was getting his boarding pass. I let him check in, answer the questions, mumbled thank you to the attendant. When he turned around, he ran into me at such short range that my face didn't register. He started to plow around me the way strangers do, just another bumper in the pinball game. Then I took his upper arm and backed him up. He focused on my face. "Hey, Alan," I said. I've seen a lot of shades of red in my time, but never one quite that bright, quite that quick to take over a complexion. I'm not sure what Brent Daniels would have done if we'd met under different circumstances, but here in a crowd, without a backup plan, he was stuck. It was my call. "Buy me a beer," I said. For one second, I really thought he was going to bolt. His knuckles on the strap of the backpack went white. Then he shoved past me, angry but slow, heading for the bar like a kid who'd been told to go to the principal's office and knew the way by heart. We sat at the same table I'd been occupying. My seat was still warm. Brent slid across from me with a beer. One for me, none for him. He passed the beer over and then waited for my reaction, like I might tell him he could go now. I didn't. "New York," I said. "Where then?" Brent let out a little hiss of air. He looked strange with the fake prescription glasses, older somehow. He also looked strange because for the first time he'd taken pains with his appearance, real pains. He was closely shaven and immaculately clean, not bad for a guy who had been a charred pile of ashes a few days ago. Apparently a few papery lies floated through his mind before he decided not to try them. Finally he just said, "I don't know." "Les hadn't thought it that far ahead?" I asked. "Or you just don't know what he had planned?" Brent shook his head. "What do you want, Navarre?" He didn't sound very anxious to hear the answer. "I don't need a confession," I said. "I know the basics. Les had to go somewhere when he got scared away from his hiding place on Medina Lake. He'd already decided you were a kindred soul. You'd spent time together. You didn't give a damn. You knew what it was like being a shell. You also knew what it was like getting suckered into something by Miranda." I waited for him to contradict me. He didn't. "Les came to you and you agreed to put him up in the upper room of the apartment, maybe a week and a half ago." Very slightly, Brent nodded. "At some point, Les got drunk. Then he got stupid. He was a pill popper. He thought he recognized something in your medicine cabinet, something cosmetically similar to one of his favorite drugs. He took it and collapsed. Diabetic coma. Maybe he didn't die right away, maybe he stayed in a coma for a while, but eventually you realized you had a dying human vegetable on your hands. Les already had plans, had an identity, had money and an escape and everything he needed to get a new start. A man in his 40s with money and no connections. Les didn't need it anymore. So you decided you'd take it. Brent Daniels didn't have much of a future, did he? And he sure as hell didn't have much of a past. You burned his body in that tractor shed apartment along with Brent Daniels' identity." Again, I could only judge the truth of what I said by Brent's eyes. Nothing snagged in his expression. He let it roll over him, not pulling back, not giving any indication anything was wrong. Or maybe he was just too dazed to let any reaction show. "That's why Les never collected his 50 grand from the boat shed. He wasn't alive to do it, and you didn't know anything about it." "How much did you know about Brent?" "With the keys to Les's new identity, maybe a change of photo or two, you could have whatever you wanted. To make it work, you must have access to at least a few of the late Mr. Meisner's accounts."
"You want to go now?" he asked.
It was clear the "you" was actually "we," that he expected somebody to put on the cuffs.
"No,"
I said. Brent stared at my beer. He let his shoulders sag down under the weight of the backpack.
"No."
Total disbelief. Incredulity. I felt some of that myself, but I still shook my head. I heard myself saying, "You've got 10 minutes. Maybe I think you deserve it. A lot more than Les St. Pierre did." Brent stayed frozen at first. Then slowly, testing the theory, he got to his feet. One thing, I said. One thing I need an answer about. He waited. I drank some more beer before I tried to speak again. Then I met Brent's eyes. There's another possible scenario, one I don't want to accept. The scenario where you gave Les those pills intentionally, knowing what they do to his alcoholic liver. Les was dead a lot longer than just a day or a few hours. He was dead long enough for you to really put the plan back together. Those septic tanks in the backyard. One of the newer ones had been buried, then dug up again just before the fire. That wasn't just coincidence. It wasn't just holding gray water, either. Brent waited. Tell me that's not the way it was. It wasn't intentional. Brent shook his head, then said, almost inaudibly, It wasn't. He shouldered his backpack a little more firmly. He met my eyes. I couldn't stand to hear those songs sung, he said. It was a mistake, letting them get out. If I heard them on the radio, Miranda singing them... He closed his eyes so tight he gave the impression of a man about to pull the trigger next to his temple. Catch your plane, I said. It was hard sounding convinced, sounding like it was really the best thing. It was even harder watching him walk away, but I did. The last I saw was his cowboy hat, just before the Latino kid riding on his dad's shoulders stepped into line and started bouncing up and down along the gateway tunnel, waving his arms out to the side like he was an airplane, obscuring my last view of Brent. The stewardess smiled and rolled her eyes at the sky cap with the empty wheelchair next to her. Kids. I got up and looked down at the beer Brent had bought me, what was left of it. I dumped it in the bromeliads and walked away. Chapter 58. My phone conversation with Professor Mitchell at UTSA lasted exactly 30 seconds. He offered me the job. I said I was honored, and I'd have to think about it. I understand, son. He tried to make his tone not too obvious that he didn't understand, that he thought I was an idiot for even hesitating. When can you let us know? I told him next week. I told him I had another kind of class to finish up between now and then. He said, fine. After hanging up, I spent a long time staring at the crepe myrtle out the kitchen window. It was a relief 20 minutes later when Irania did her customary unsyncopated rat-tat-tat on the screen door frame. When I opened the door, Jem laughed and just about launched a 2-layer cake into my chest as he came in. Fortunately, I caught the cake while it was still in one piece and raised it up, allowing Jem free rein to tackle me. Robert Johnson mewed a complaint and disappeared into the closet. He probably remembered the last time the Monoses had come over. Irania stepped in and looked around my apartment. So, you're still alive. You don't call. Why? You forget the number? Jem was explaining to me about the cake. He told me that we'd have to wait until I really finished my hours to eat it, but he'd made it himself with his food coloring kit, and I wouldn't believe the colors inside when I opened it. The outside was forbidding enough. Lumpy gray frosting that looked like the product of a cement finger painting session. The layers uneven and off-center, so the cake seemed to be leaning away from me on its plate. It's just about the nicest cake I've ever seen, Bubba. Jem giggled, then went to find the cat. In the top of the closet, a shoebox moved. Irania was still waiting for an answer to her question. She was giving me the look of death treatment, her black eyes bugging toward me and her taloned fingers tapping her forearm. I got 10 hours left, I told her. That's about one job. You figure we can avoid arguing that long? It's 20, she reminded me. And I don't know, honey. You gonna get yourself sidetracked again? Professor Mitchell is probably wondering the same thing. Irania frowned. Mitchell who? I said, yes, I'm willing to finish up. You? Irania thought about it, weighing the pros and cons. I suppose the Longoria case could have gone better if I'd had a dumb-looking guy for a decoy, honey. I suppose there's advantages. Maybe you got a little raw potential. Nothing amazing, you understand. And what about after the 20 hours? Jem came back over with Robert Johnson hanging by his armpits from Jem's hands. Robert Johnson's toes fully extended, and the tiny white V on his crotch showing in his face looking like he would die from mortification any second. Jem looked troubled.
Where's Miranda?
He just made the connection, remembered his trick-or-treat partner, and remembered that she had some vague association with Trace when she wasn't being Jem's little Miss Muffet. Irania waited to hear an answer to both questions, hers and Jem's. She was chewing on the inside of her mouth, her lips turning sideways.
Miranda had to go, Bubba. She's going to be a singer in Nashville. Isn't that cool?
Jem didn't look impressed. Neither did Robert Johnson. Both turned and left. Probably going to play Wet Kitty, Dry Kitty in the bathroom.
You need anything, honey?
Irania's voice was softer now, so much so that I had to look to make sure she had really been the one speaking. She frowned immediately.
What?
Nothing. And no. Thanks. Irania looked out the window at the afternoon in progress. Gary Hales was in the front yard watering his sidewalk. Across the street, a red Mazda Miata was just pulling up in front of the Suitez house. The Mazda was loaded so heavily with cardboard moving boxes that the trunk was half open, precariously fastened with a crisscross of cords. Alison St. Pierre looked across the street, trying to make sure she remembered which house was mine. Last time she was here, she'd been drunk. Irania and I exchanged looks.
Nashville, honey.
It's not that. She did a backhand slap in the air.
Eh?
I'll wrap the cake in saran wrap. Maybe it'll keep. Knowing how Irania applied saran wrap, I had the feeling the cake would keep several centuries. I went outside. Allison saw me coming and sat on the hood of the red Mazda and waited. She was holding a backpack, my backpack, the one I'd left with the maid at her Monta Vista house. Allison was already warming up her head shake as I walked across Queen Anne Street. By the time I got to her, she was going pretty well with it.
What is this?
She demanded. She held the backpack up by one shoulder strap.
A very old backpack, I said.
A souvenir. I figured I didn't need it anymore. She sighed through her nose.
I mean, what's in it, sweetie? You lost your mind?
It's Les's money, I said, or part of it. He forgot the stash. We found it. I figured you're right. Some of it should go to you. Allison's eyes couldn't quite get a fix on me. They were wandering around the space where I was, not really seeing. She looked sloppy today, moving time sloppy, her hair pinned up and her T-shirt streaked with old cobwebs, and her legs below her cutoffs scraped and smudged with dirt. Her face was etched with tiny white wrinkles like cracked glass.
You're just giving me $25,000?
She said, incredulous. $24,300, I corrected.
I know.
She'd counted. The fact that I had two made her even more incredulous.
Is this because...
I shook my head. It's not because of anything. I know what Les's estate looks like. I know that his name isn't going to be worth as much as you hoped. The court is going to be paying off his debts first, and I doubt there's going to be much for you. You're broke. That didn't seem to answer her question. She knew all that already. She kept staring at me, mad now.
So give this to the judge, like you said, she said.
I don't know the judge. I know you. She finally lowered the backpack. She still looked angry.
Exactly.
A car went past. Behind me, Gary Hales's watering hose sprayed across the cement and droplets thudded into the grass. He must have been busy watching us. His aim was off. You're still going back to Falfurious? I asked.
You sure you want to know?
We locked eyes. I looked away first.
Damn you.
She was shaking her head again now, trying to stay angry, but with a tiny smile starting to form. Pardon?
You've got to go and keep the damn door open, don't you? You got to give me just enough to think that maybe all men aren't complete shits. Why the fuck did you do this?
Think about less, I suggested. There's still a strong case. She sighed. You were right, I told her, about him running off, about getting away free and leaving everybody else with a mess. You were right all along.
Big comfort.
She turned and threw the backpack in the shotgun window. Besides, I said, it was 25,000. She frowned.
What?
The amount. I was going to give you $25,000. I scammed 700. You can blame me for that. She stared at me. I pointed my toe in the air. Reimbursed myself for these here boots, paid my rent. They cost about the same amount. Allison cracked a smile.
I've seen your apartment. The boots were a better deal.
Then she came up and put her arms around me. Her fingers traced my skin, remembering exactly where the sword tip scar was, circling around it. She kissed me long enough for Gary Hales to water the tree, the street, the front bumper on my VW, long enough for me to forget how to breathe. Then she pushed lightly away, bumped my forehead with hers.
Come down to Falfuria sometime, she said.
And you'll introduce me to your four brothers, I managed to say. She grinned. She tweaked my ear with her fingers and it stung.
Them you could handle, sweetie.
After the red Miata drove away, I stood in the middle of Queen Anne Street until a family Land Rover drove up and tapped its horn. Excuse us. I moved to the front yard, looked at Gary Hales.
That one's gone, I told him.
Yeah,
Gary agreed, disappointed. Fortunately, I'd paid my rent. That gave me 30 days to find either more money or more blondes. I figured the odds were about even. I went inside to see about some cake.
The End. You've been listening to The Widower's Two-Step by Rick Riordan, narrated by Tom Stecciotti. Thank you for listening to Lone Star Audiobooks.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.